This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio. The Fourth Estate is RCR's newest discussion panel, where our host and guest cast a critical eye over the New Zealand media. Today's host is Marie Buskey, with her guests David Harvey and Peter Williams. It's time for the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Reality Check Radio here with Marie. And it is time for the Fourth Estate. It's so good to have this back. Alistair kicked things off last week for us. This week joining me is David Harvey, former judge, mastermind, winner, blogger, and man who is far from a halfling's view. How are you, David?
Well, thanks, Marie. Thanks for that introduction.
It's very good to have you. And of course, joining us is our beloved Peter Williams, friend of RCR, which we adore greatly. Good to have you as a regular fixture here now, as well as our TV screens. And of course, AFS returnee from back in the day.
Yeah, that's about the only thing that David and I have in common. We're both AFS students from days gone by.
Really?
So, we have that experience of having lived in the United States as teenagers many, many moons ago.
Well, we're in for the trifecta, aren't we? 89, 90.
Oh, really?
Well done, you.
Gosh, you're a mere child, Marie. 71, 72. How about you, David?
64, 65.
Oh, stop
my
it.
Gosh.
I was there for Johnson and Goldwater.
Wow. See, there you go.
There and, doesn't
it show you the value of stuff like that from what you can actually go off and do in the future? There you go. Hey, look, there's been lots of to-ing and fro-ing in the media in the last several weeks. And last time we caught up, well, David and I certainly caught up in the break and had a look at what was going on in terms of the changes and the sort of dust settling. What we now have is, you know, it's a bit like a departure airport lounge situation with comings and goings and movings around. And there's quite a few of them. I mean, let's have a look. We've got Simon Barnett moving from ZB back across to More FM. Mike McRoberts going to NBR. Sinead is busy feathering the nest at stuff now that she's going to be flush with funds. So you've got Lizette Raymer, which I thought was a good catch. They're pulling the team together there. Samantha Hayes going across. And then what else have I got on my list? The Block gets the chop. So there's a lot to sort of chew in there. So let's kick things off with Simon Barnett first. That one I was surprised about.
Well, I think it comes down to money. Simon, of course, has had a major personal upheaval in the last few months with his wife, Jodie, tragically dying of cancer in her early 60s. Simon has been an extraordinarily, brilliant husband, family man, four daughters. The family, his wife, meant everything to him. It always seemed a bit odd that he went from More FM and the music station and pretty lighthearted stuff to the talk station at ZB. But I remember when the move was made, 2018, 2019, it was explained to me that it was about one very simple thing, and that was money. And NZME, as opponents of Media Works, figured that if they took Simon Barnett out of breakfast on More FM, got him onto ZB, they would deprive Media Works of something like $500,000 a year. That's the draw that Barnett had for Media Works. So he was taken across to ZB at a very, very high salary. That salary subsequently had to be split into two because he didn't want to do a four-hour talk show by himself. He had firstly Phil Gifford, more latterly James Daniels. And he's done that for what, 5-6 years or whatever? But obviously he feels it's a bit boring. Afternoons on radio full stop are a bit of a dead man zone, to be perfectly honest, having done that shift a few times myself, not necessarily in talk radio, but particularly in talk radio, it is just hard going. Mm. People don't really give a toss about wanting to ring you up during the afternoon. That's why latterly more and more of those afternoon talk shows have been two-man or two-person shows because people can talk to each other. So Simon has obviously had enough of this, decided that he wants to get back to something a bit more lighthearted. No doubt Media Works put a very, very attractive financial offer in front of him. So he's going back to the future, going back to what he was doing in 2018, 2019. So good luck to him. I mean, he is the world's nicest guy. He never has a bad word to say about anybody. So I'm sure that MediaWorks, who have been battling in their own right with their music stations, are pretty keen to have achieved this particular victory. Whether or not Simon Barnett in 2025 will be the same draw on a music station as he was in the golden years remains to be seen. After all, we all move on. The media industry moves on. Consumer habits move on. But MediaWorks have decided that for now it's worth $500,000 gamble. So away he goes back.
It's interesting because, I mean, I wondered whether or not it would be he was finding the atmosphere with ZB too negative with in terms of callers coming in, and he wanted to go back to something a little bit more positive and lighthearted. My only concern were the listeners of More FM today. Do they even know who Simon Barnett is?
I couldn't tell you because I've never been one. I don't know any. I don't follow radio ratings all that much these days, so I don't know how More FM goes. What I do know is that at breakfast time, they seem to put out two morning shows, don't they? They've got the network show, which presumably is what Simon is going back to, and they've got a whole lot of local shows as well. So they split their breakfast audience in most regions in two, which is in itself is an extraordinary strategy, but maybe they're ditching that and going back to one network show. I don't know. But all I'll say is that talk in the afternoons on ZB is pretty lighthearted, pretty inconsequential. There's no real meaty issues ever discussed in depth. It's more about, as the consultants would say, Marie, it's about talking about experiences as opposed to opinions. And
it's
I guess
feels,
that, Simon has had enough of that and he's going back to have a bit more fun in the mornings.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, David?
Well, I know that Simon's had a tremendous upheaval in his own personal life. And it's not unexpected in that sort of situation that as part of working through that, you look at other changes in the way that you're living and what your values and expectations are. So it's probably no surprise that he should have decided to make this change. What I think it is interesting in the sort of broader picture is the way that two media organizations are fiercely competitive. And that, from my point of view, that is a very good thing. Because although the media would like to unite in many respects, and we'll probably talk about that later on, there should be this type of competition. Now, I know that it sounds cutthroat and I know that it sounds brutal, but if you don't have that type of approach to business, then you're not going to succeed. You can be a nice guy in business for sure. But the thing is, how does that reflect in your bottom line for your shareholders or for your owners, like Warner Discovery or whatever? So in terms of an indication of competitiveness within the media landscape, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know I've always worked in markets where there's been, you know, a competitive environment and it keeps you on your game. You know, as a broadcaster, because you can get, I think that's one of the things with, I do wonder about RNZ, you know, because they, in a way, because they know they have that underwritten funding, there sometimes can be, not a rot, but they can certainly rest on secure laurels.
I listened to RNZ for something like about 10 years. Particularly on the drive home, you know, getting from South Auckland to Epsom, sometimes took a long time on the motorway. And, you know, RNZ with some of its shows was actually quite interesting. But on reflection, nothing changed. It was the same old radio station, and maybe because I'm old, white, male, conservative, that was a good thing for me as a listener. I knew what to expect, but it didn't change. There was no development whatsoever. It was the same voices, the same points of view coming through. Hey, there's no need for them to adapt their business model, because, as you say, they've got support from the state sitting underneath them.
Well, it's not a business, so you don't need to adapt it, really. The other one that I found, speaking of businesses, that was intriguing was Mike McRoberts going across to NBR for, as the Te Ao Māori reporter. I find this really interesting. The classic NBR consumer, how interested in Te Ao Māori business would they be?
They're going to have to be. It's as simple as that. McRoberts, you know, presents an interesting sort of picture, because not only is he just a presenter, but he's a very, very fine journalist. And one of the things that impressed me particularly about him was his ability to get dust on his boots when the occasion arose, and he would go out into the front line report, and that was excellent. That was first rate. The other thing that's interested me, as far as he is concerned, is the way in which he has developed his own particular identity as Māori. Now, this sort of feeds into a whole lot of other issues as well, but it doesn't surprise me that NBR is setting up a Te Ao Māori capsule, if you like, because the whole issue of Māori tikanga and so on and so forth is beginning to weave its way into the major fabric of New Zealand society. Now, whether you like this or not, it's happening. And I think that NBR has probably scored themselves a real hit as far as McRoberts is concerned, because they've got themselves a fine journalist, and he will be able to report in what I would hope to be and what I would expect to be an unbiased way about Māori issues and the way that these things come through. I mean, within the legal profession, just at the moment, we're having a huge argument as to whether or not the teaching of tikanga should be a compulsory part of a law degree. And there are opposing views on that. But the way I see it is that it is going to happen. Tikanga is going to become part of the law, probably not as a separate stream of law, but it will become part of the law in the same way that custom, way back in the old days, became part of the law. So I think that the idea of NBR having the Te Ao Māori section is not something that's unusual, not something that's strange. In fact, I think that NBR is anticipating what's coming down the track.
I think it's intriguing, Marie, that NBR, which in the days of Barry Coleman, going right back to its formation and when 1970, when people like Hugh Reddy set it up, it has always been a very right-wing, right-leaning publication. Since Todd Scott took it over, he has made some really intriguing hires amongst his journalists. Dieter de Boney is obviously the one that stands out, having spent some time in a newsroom with her. She is a good old-fashioned lefty, and her opinion pieces well and truly, you know, suggest and explain that when she writes in the NBR. McRoberts is the classic inner-city Auckland liberal, even though he's born and raised in Christchurch. But he has been in Auckland for so long now that he is well and truly a Greyland lefty. So you've got the NBR having a real swing in its, editorial stance. What I want to see from Mike, though, is now that he has this job, one presumes with pretty much an open book in front of him as to what he can investigate, what he can ask about, is, you know, let's talk about some key issues. Do Māori and corporations pay tax? Why not? Do they have a significant advantage over the rest of New Zealand business by not paying tax? This is one basic query that I would like to have investigated and get comment from both sides of the argument, because we are told that iwi have had these significant settlements, which they've used to invest and grow into billion-dollar businesses, a la Ngāi Tahu and Tainui in particular. Yet along the way, they have made some dreadful investments. A lot of other iwi have made some appalling investments, basically lost their lost the settlement money that they had because they made some poor investments. Yet there's been this massive tax advantage that we're being told about. So that's just one basic story that I would like to see investigated in depth. I don't want to see a constant series of cheerleading stories for Māori business success, which I'm afraid when I look at that appointment, I'm thinking that's what I might be getting. And, you know, I'll just wait until there is some content on the page before I make a decision about it. But I hope it's going to be some good hard-hitting stuff, a la what Tim Hunter does when he gives the likes of those dodgy property developers like the Duval Corporation the absolute what to in the NBR, because they blinking well deserve it. I'm hoping that Māori business failure is also analysed and criticised in the same way that Tim Hunter does. But we will wait and see.
Yeah, and a lot of it too is the whole titiriti, whether you're titiriti-led or whether you're treaty-led. And there definitely seems to be a division in Māoridom around this. I mean, I'm talking, again, very soon with Mātāmua Taitui. Now, he was born and raised in, he's Tainui, born and raised in the Kingitanga movement. And he's works in lecturing in economics. And he's very frustrated with all of these things, as you outlined, Peter. And it will be interesting to see whether Mick Roberts is able to have conversations which can be confronting for those that he pops down and has a Chardonnay with at the end of the workday.
Mm. You know, because we saw that, didn't we, with some years ago before she sort of completely stepped back, was Mihi Forbes, when she tried to criticise or attempted to criticise, was it the Kohanga Reo movement or some part of Māori preschool education and the financial skullduggery that was going on. Once she raised those issues in public, she was hit upon from a great height by important people within Māoridom. She withdrew into her shell and we've never heard another word about it. So that's what bothers me about reporting on Māori business, that if you start criticising them, then important people might start doing not very nice things to you.
Well, Mike, if you're listening and you want to get your teeth into something, why don't you come back home to your ancestral home, because I know you're Ngāti Kānuhu, pop back here to Hawke's Bay and have a look at what happened in regards to Tiki Timu Seafoods. I'd love to know. I'd love to know about the millions of dollars that were spent and lost there. I think that would be a great place to start because, you know, that's your home patch. Come home. Kia ora whānau, come home and tell us what's going on there. I think that would be a brilliant story to kick things off with.
You know something, Ms. Buskey?
I couldn't quite possibly say, Mr. Williams.
All right.
Indeed. Now, of course, Sinead. So, of course, the staff are now looking at taking over the 6 p.m. bulletin. Samantha Hayes, Mike's offsider, has going to front it. Lizette Raymer, I thought, was a really good catch, actually, for that show. I think she's done some really solid work, particularly in the international space. They're pulling together production team. Now, it will be news done differently. And this is, I think, ties into this. And my question for both of you is, you know, they say that necessity is the mother of all invention. There's been lots of talk about how devastating this is for news by losing this production news bulletin and news hub. But is it really that bad? Could this produce something that is different and potentially better?
Marie, it hasn't happened. You know, we are getting a 6 o'clock news from the inheritors of News Hub. So all of the fears, all of the worries, all of the terror, all of the threats to democracy and all of the rest of that hasn't happened. Why? Because as an example of something I mentioned earlier, the market has sorted it out, as indeed it should. Yeah, there'll be different faces and there'll be a different approach. And I imagine that it will be a pretty much a staff-led approach. But it will be there. The thing is, whether or not it will produce and disseminate the news in a way that gathers the trust and confidence of viewers. Because right now, trust and confidence is something that media justifiably is very, very worried about. So that, there is a lot of rebuilding work that has to happen. This could be a wonderful opportunity for that. But given that stuff is behind it, I hang it in.
What are your thoughts, Peter?
Oh, I imagine that if stuff is the overriding owner of this, the general angle will be from the left, it'll be anti-government. Samantha Hayes as a presenter, well, that's nice. She's perfectly competent. Mike decided he wanted to move into other things, as we've just discussed. Lisette Raymer, yes, very talented journalist. Extraordinary, really. When I was at TVNZ, it was decreed that she did not have the look and did not have the ability to be a potential good reporter, potentially a good reporter. So they just let her go. Off she went from Victoria Street over to Flower Street, and the rest is history. And she has been an absolutely outstanding European and foreign correspondent for them. So a really good get for them. I thought that she might have followed in the path of one or two of her predecessors who have been European correspondents and just stayed there, frankly. When she lost her job or when NewsHub was due to close down, I thought she might have wanted to just stay on in Britain and work out a life in a bigger media market. But good for her, she'll come back and try the stuff approach. The big problem with what's going to happen with stuff is that it's going to be a budget production. I don't know how many camera crew they're hiring. Are people going to have to shoot stuff on iPhones? Is it going to have smart graphics? Is Jenna Lynch, for instance, going to have a political staff, or is she just going to have to do the whole political reporting gig by herself? What happens when there's two or three really big stories at Parliament on a day? It looks like it's a bit of a skeleton staff. Sure, there'll be some the resources of stuff in behind, but how many of the stuff reporters have acceptable broadcast voices, acceptable broadcast persona? You can be a very good print journalist and become a pretty useless television journalist. And I put up for my case for the prosecution Andrea Vance, a very good print journalist, frankly, was pretty disappointing when she came to TV. So, yeah, the resources of stuff will be there. I'll rest my judgment until they've been on air for a few weeks. But it just smacks to me of being a little bit on the cheap side, really. You can't just jump between one medium and the next at will and do a very good job on both. So we will see, but there will still be a 6 o'clock news. Whether or not I show any more interest in the whole concept of watching a 6 o'clock news remains to be seen, because in my daily life, it's not exactly a top priority at the moment.
Well, I think it's quite...
It hasn't been for some time.
I think it's quite quaint that you think they're doing a good good job in print format. But there you go. because Michael Moore was the other one I didn't mention. I mean, he's popped across to the Herald. I think that that's probably a good fit for him. I was terrified that he would go over with this new group, because I think he would have been wasted. He did some really good work, I know, down here around the flag.
Probably stuff didn't want to know about, and that would be the difficulty, because he might just occasionally challenge the government and perhaps be, heaven forbid, a little bit too right-leaning, Marie. Just a thought.
Yeah, balanced even, telling a story that's right in front of you. Look, I have to admit, some of the stuff he covered here during Cyclone Gabrielle, it was good, because he actually talked about and discussed things that everyone else was trying to sort of gloss over, but we, all of us on the ground, knew what was going on, and he was the only one. He was the only one that would go out to some of these orchards and see where actually money was going that was being donated, and how it was being very generously funneled in one direction and not in another. And yeah, he did a great job, and I'm pleased that I think you'll find a happy home with the Herald. And I mean, they're increasing their digital content, particularly in video format, and I'm picking that that's where he will end up fronting up and just putting it out there, you know, with the demise of Sunday, I think that there is actually an opportunity for the Herald to create something like that in a digital realm, and or even like a Fair Go type thing. They're looking at moving that across to digital.
Yeah. We'll see. I don't know. I'm of a certain age where, you know, I still like a newspaper if I can get one. You know, I live in Otago, therefore the Otago Daily Times, still in broadsheet, still gets delivered to my letterbox every day. Yeah, I'm an old-fashioned, I suppose, media consumer. Would I ever watch a current affairs show on the laptop that I'm broadcasting on at the moment or talking on at the moment? Probably not, because I just, you know, it's got to be, you know, an appointment, almost an appointment viewing, or somebody has to tell me about it. I'm just not that interested. I find that listening on the radio while I go about my daily work with my earbuds in and reading the ODT at lunchtime is about my media consumption at the moment. So I'm just an old-fashioned old fuddy-duddy, and this newfangled computer on the, you know, video on the computer, oh, you can have it. In fact, my subscription to the Herald Premium ran out the other day, and for various reasons, my credit card number has changed in the last year. And they've been on my case saying, please update your credit card, otherwise you won't be renewed. And I thought, this is a very, very good excuse to not pay $500 and something per year to the Herald, because really, I don't need it.
There you go. The Block is on the chopping block. Now, David, I know you never missed an episode. I'm sure of it. The Block on TV3. I was surprised, to be fair.
So The Block's on the block.
The Block is on the block.
Oh,
yeah, no,
absolutely, absolutely brilliant. And they could follow it up with a few other programs as well of the same type of quality or absence of it. The Block, probably My Kitchen Rules, Celebrity Treasure Island, Get Naked on the Beach, all of that type of stuff, absolute rubbish. It can go.
Good. Married at First Sight.
Yeah, well, Mark Richardson, bless his heart, would be devastated. You know, dare I say it, so being somebody who does some advertising from time to time in the day job on linear TV, Married at First Sight, we do placements specifically into Married at First Sight because the feedback, I know it's dreadful, but people love it.
One person particularly that I know very, very well watches Married at First Sight, which means that I get expelled from the TV room, or I expel myself, simply because enjoys the travelogues and, you know, the various places that they send people to and so on and so forth. That's it. As far as, you know, the relationships and so on and so forth, it's not an issue, but for her, it's a travel show.
Well, see, here's the interesting thing with The Block. For the longest time, it was always the most successful and biggest money-making show for MediaWorks. So it makes me wonder what Time Warner Discovery have seen in order to cancel it. They'd already purchased the next round of properties to actually do it again, and they have canned it. So it makes you wonder whether things are a little bit more dire than they're wanting to let on, or I don't know.
Good. Well,
I think it comes down to something called yield, does it not? We know that both Sunday and Fair Go were profitable programs in that they attracted more advertising than their cost of production for the hour and the half hour that they were on air respectively. But the yield apparently was not good enough. Therefore, they had to go. And I just wonder if the same fate has befallen The Block. It seemed to have been a reasonably successful program. I've never watched it, but Richardson, who's moved on to a career now as a financial advisor, is pretty much out of the broadcasting game. He says he'll be disappointed and it was a part of his life, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, once upon a time, cricket was part of his life and then TV and then radio. And now it's obviously being a financial advisor. So, you know, he's one of these chameleons who jumps from life to life, and good for him. I admire him to be able to have the skills to be able to do that. As some old hack who got stuck in the media game for half a century, I'm really jealous of people having the ability to make a living in all sorts of fields.
Yeah, but the concept of yield, just before we jump into the DIA, the concept of yield, it's interesting how they don't apply that lens across things, for example, like Māori TV or Te Māngai Pāho or anything like that.
Because that's just taxpayer money.
Yeah, because there's been no cancellations in that space. And
I think there ever will be.
But it just really, I find that quite, I mean, it's not that I'm saying that there shouldn't be content there for Māori on Māori TV, and I've watched some great stuff. However, you've got an entire channel where you've got own series of dramas and all of these other elements. As you said, Sunday and Fair Go are two bastions of broadcast. I mean, I have to admit, if they cancelled Country Calendar, I think things will, we know that it's time to leave the country.
Is Country Calendar still NZ On Air funded or partially funded? Do they give a credit for that at the end, or is it, because it was for a while, I know that.
Yeah, I know that they've got a good sponsorship deal currently with Hyundai. But could you imagine?
Oh, no, there'd be an absolute outcry, because that is the longest running show in New Zealand. I think it started in 1966, so it's even 11 years senior to Fair Go. So, it would be a tragedy. And you're right, Marie, nothing can go on forever, but jeepers, Coronation Street has.
Well, yeah, indeed. Right, let's jump into the Department of Internal Affairs rolling back this thing. Firstly, I have to say, I thought the Free Speech Union were being a touch cheeky with some of their comms. A touch cheeky.
What, claiming it as a victory?
Well, for them. Yeah,
just sort of following that little sideline, Marie, the reason that they say that, disclosure, I'm a member of the FSU, and I thought that they were crowing a little bit loudly, but the reason that they were was that the majority of the submissions that were made either came from templates that were put out by Voices for Freedom or the Free Speech Union. Some 18,000 of the 20,000 or whatever it was came from Voices for Freedom and the FSU. So I suppose what they could say from a numerical point of view is this was a victory for us. But I think if you look at it from another point of view, even although there were all of those template-based submissions, it's a victory for common sense. In terms of recognizing that what you are dealing with in terms of trying to regulate content on the internet is a very, very slippery eel, and one that you're going to have a lot of difficulty actually grabbing and defining. And I think for a number of reasons, particularly the scope of what was proposed and the rationale for it, it has been decided not to proceed with this particular piece of work. Now, one of the issues that I have in particular, and I've studied and written on internet regulation and so on for many, many years now, is that when you're trying to regulate content on the internet, that's just what floats on the surface of what's going on. Whereas in reality, what you should be looking at is, in fact, the technology itself. And what you really need to do, if you're serious about this, is that you're going to have to try and regulate the technology. And that's a tricky thing, because the minute you start doing that and you start interfering with some pretty significant fundamentals of how the internet works, the internet has developed in the way that it has because of what in fact is a very permissive approach to what you can do with the back button, with the technology that's there. It means that reality check radio can bolt on to the internet and go for it. It means that Google can bolt on. It means that Facebook can bolt on. It means that the New Zealand Herald can bolt on. And that sort of permissiveness about what you can do online has been one of the features of the internet ever since it started. And that has also encouraged innovation In the space that has continued and developed and is continuing and developing now. And artificial intelligence, so-called, is just another example of that continuing innovation. But the thing about the Department of Internal Affairs propositions was that it was based primarily on the assumption that the current regulatory environment was no longer fit for purpose. So you had things like the Films, Videos and Publications Classification Act, which dealt with objectionable content, which is really, really nasty, and that's fair enough. You had the Broadcasting Standards Authority, which had codes of practice set up, and I'll come back to that in a moment. You have the New Zealand Media Council, which is a voluntary organisation, which was set up and the inheritor of the Press Council. You've got the Advertising Standards Authority, which is another of the organisations that sort of internal regulation. And then you have the Harmful Digital Communications Act, which deals with online. Now, within that entire space, you actually have a very, very comprehensive approach to regulation. The fact, of course, is that it's distributed among a number of organisations and a number of statutes. And there's an abhorrence on the part of some regulators for that particular model. They like it all neatly and in one place, which is what the DIA proposals were set to do. See, the thing, for example, with the Broadcasting Standards Authority is that they have the ability to develop codes of practice. And the codes of practice that have been developed by the BSA have changed over the years and are modified, and so keep up with what's going on. So to say that that particular legislation is no longer fit for purpose is rubbish, because they have this internal regulatory system whereby they make rules and codes which have the effect of secondary legislation and that are binding upon broadcasters. Not so with the New Zealand Media Council, which is a voluntary organisation. But if you want to have the benefits of being a member of the media, and that does have certain benefits, then you've got to be associated with the New Zealand Media Council. But what the proposal here was with the DIA was they wanted to regulate content generally. But what you've got to remember is that sitting behind the classification system in the Films, Videos and Publications Classification is the Department of Internal Affairs. They're a censorship outfit. And the problem that you have is that they were applying a censorship frame of mind to content on the internet. They were suggesting that there would be codes of conduct for the various platforms and so on and so forth, which is just a reflection of what the Broadcasting Standards Authority does. But it was so wide-reaching that it was going to have significant implications for freedom of expression online, the ability to engage in robust debate. Now, of course, there's unfortunate behaviour like trolling and all of that sort of thing. But frankly, I would rather have that than have restrictions on what you can say and what you can't say online. I prefer polite conversation, and that's been the way that I was brought up. Others don't. That's fine. I've been the victim of a bit of trolling over the last week. And hey, more power to their arm. They've got the ability to say what they want to say. The fact that it might be unkind or whatever, I don't give a damn. Go for it.
Is this a victim, well, potentially, around weaponized language? Because there's a lot of use of language where you have very, very oblique views. And you touched on this on your Safer Online Services post on your Substack, in terms of words like harm and safety.
Yep.
Who defines what is harmful? Who defines what is safe?
Well, harmful under the Harmful Digital Communications Act, you really have a harm. It is serious emotional distress. And that is something which can be objectively assessed. It's not enough to go along and say, I'm offended. You need something a little bit more. You need to have some kind of external characteristics that indicate that there's been emotional distress, loss of sleep, inability to perform at work, rapid mood swings, all of that type of thing. And it can be supported by evidence. Safety is another word but that's sort of thrown around with gay abandon these days. And basically what they're talking about is living life in a risk-free manner. Well, sorry, I take a risk every time I get out of bed in the morning. And this morning is a classic example. I got out of bed the wrong way and twisted my back. It's a bit sore, so there was a risk there. It's not very safe getting out of bed. And as Bilbo said to Frodo in The Lord of the Rings, you know, it's a big business stepping outside your door and going on the road. You never know where it's going to lead. And that sums up for me the fact that life involves risk and you're never going to be completely safe. So acknowledge risk and deal with the risk and try and guard against risk as much as you can. Instead of planting your boot when the light is orange, think about it. Think about what might happen if you do that, and rather slow down and stop for the orange light before it turns red. That's a way of eliminating risk. But, you know, that's me being safe. As a consequence, other people are kept safe as well. But primarily, it's about me being safe. And this whole sort of risk-free environment that many organizations talk about, Internet NZ and Toa Toa and many of the other outfits that would like to see regulated content on the Internet, they don't realize that what they are talking about is a risk-free society, which you can never attain.
Well, it's almost impossible to put that digital genie back in the bottle now.
Correct.
And now that the hate speech laws were dramatically defanged, this then appeared and there has been a pushback in it. You know, Brooke Van Velden has said that there is not a lot of appetite for it. Peter, do you think, or either of you, do you think that they will try and work out something else? I mean, there's the merger between...
On that, Marie, it's probably important to note that although the hate speech thing has been shelved, the hate crime continues, and I don't know exactly what that's all about, and we'll have to look and wait and see. As far as safer online services are concerned, that's gone. But it doesn't mean that the drive for media regulation has stopped. And in fact, Dr. Gavin Ellis has put out a paper from COIT2, the Centre for New Zealand Futures at Auckland University, entitled If Not Journalists, Who? And that's a very, very interesting discussion about possible regulatory models, which in some respects reflect aspects of the Safer Online Services. So while Safer Online Services project with the DIA itself is gone, wait, there's more coming.
Yeah. I think also a subject such as this is always going to be partisan. You can toss around words like independent all you like. But I think of, and this is sort of a classic case of, we'll hammer the right, we'll hammer the old white man, but younger Maori women can get away with anything. And a couple of examples of that last week was the response, what I think was an absolutely disgraceful response by the Dean of the AUT Law School, Kylie Quince, to Gary Judd, KC, raising in a most rational and reasonable way the potential appearance of tikanga as a compulsory subject at law schools from next year. And Kylie Quince, in a manner that was unbecoming not just for a law professor, but unbecoming for any nice person in society, said that Gary Judd was a racist old dinosaur who should go away in the corner and die. Now, there was absolutely no pushback from anybody in any sort of authority about that comment, which I believe might be the most disgraceful online comment made by anybody this year. There was also the comment made by the member of the Maori Party in the House about how this government wants to exterminate Maori. Okay, she said that under parliamentary privilege. But again, not much reporting, not much pushback against it. But the Kylie Quince comment I just find unconscionable. and the fact that this so-called academic could not engage in a rational and reasonable discussion about a pretty contentious topic says plenty to me about both her and about the law school that she leads. So the difficulty is that if there had been some kind of hate speech law brought through to fruition, or some kind of harmful content law brought through to fruition, would an independent regulator come down on somebody like Kylie Quince? Of course they wouldn't. Not a show, not a hope in Hades of that happening. So therefore, the idea of a regulated internet is just impractical and impossible, because it just would never, ever be fair to people like Gary Judd. He would probably, in all likelihood, be the one who would have pushback against him for racist discussion. But
when Kylie Quinn said that,
I'm sure he did. But when Kylie Quinn said that, I just thought, my God, that's got to be the end of the line as far as AUT law is concerned. And what's more, not one comment from the vice chancellor or the chancellor of that university.
One of the interesting things on the Gary Judd issue, and this probably illustrates the glory of the internet rather than the threats that it poses, is that after Kylie Quince made her comments, Gary Judd came out swinging. And he did a session with Sean Plunkett on the other radio, internet radio platform, and answered Kylie Quince in a very rational and straightforward way, but really quite aggressively too. And of course, this demonstrates the democratization that the internet allows. He had an opportunity to respond, and he took it. Whereas in a previous environment, an earlier environment of paradigm, that particular point of view might not have gotten put across, but it was, and it was well publicized too. Mm.
Because this didn't appear in many legacy media platforms, but it did appear crop up in the Sunday Star Times of 12th of May. Government swerves away from tackling industrial-grade violence found online. And Kevin Norkey took a crack at it. And he, talking about Kylie Quince, I think she appeared on the Snuff Circuit Fire and Fury documentary, and which, of course, Kate Hanna was up to her eyeballs in, and her offsider, Sanjana Hatatawa, is quoted here. And it's interesting what you were saying in terms of the partisan nature of this, Peter. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there as well. And Hatatawa says here that it seems the government was underestimating the dangers. The Disinformation Project Research Director told Sunday Star Times the day before the announcement, there doesn't seem to be any recognition, oversight, acknowledgement, or meaningful government response that I've remotely seen, and I am good at what I do. He's a modest wee lad, isn't he? I am good at what I do. He then goes on to say...
He doesn't cite authorities, though, for his propositions. He doesn't cite his sources.
Look, that's a very novel, old-fashioned concept, David.
He responds emotionally rather than rationally. But, hey, yeah, of course it's an old-fashioned concept, but it's the foundation of good scholarship.
And he goes on to say, Hatatawa felt the government was being complacent, saying government agencies tasked with public safety online were among those set for resource cuts. News of the Digital Safety Group staff cuts really goes to what is at the heart of the problem, which is that I don't think the government knows how bad it is. If the cuts go through, there's a very high likelihood that they will, that this is the kind of antithesis of what you should be doing. While Terragram, which is a UK-based and it's been formed illegal neo-fascist group in the UK, it remains easily discoverable in New Zealand. Sorry. While Telegram material is classified as objectionable, it remains easily discoverable in New Zealand, and it is spread to groups outside of the neo-Nazi fold, anti-vax, anti-mandate, anti-government, says Hatatawa.
In other words,
he's entitled to agree with me. He's entitled to his point of view, and he's entitled to express it. That's what freedom of expression is all about. I would suggest, though, probably underlying his concerns is the fact that it's probably very likely that the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet is no longer providing funding for the disinformation project, and no doubt they're going to have to look for money elsewhere. I don't know, but they've been remarkably silent for a little while. It doesn't surprise me that Ottawa should have come out with comments like that on the eve of the notification. There was, in fact, an early indication from the PIA that this announcement was going to be made. So what he's obviously tried to do is to present them. But he's entitled to his point of view, and he's entitled to express it, and more power to his own.
Yeah, I think, Marie, the biggest danger on the internet is not people making nasty comments or so-called malinformation, misinformation, disinformation, call it what you want. But it's something that you, as a mother of teenage boys, me as a grandfather of a teenage boy, and a friend of a woman with a young man in his early 20s, the biggest threat to their mental well-being and livelihood as time goes on is just the preponderance and the ease of accessibility of pornography on the internet. And I had a woman last week who was around at my place. She has this young man in his early 20s who's now off at university. And she described him as a recovering porn addict. And I think he's 21 now. But basically, he battled like heck all through his high school years. And it was just normal. They were all doing it. And now I've got this 13-year-old grandson, and my God, I just worry about him because he's got the digital phone, the mobile phone, and already it's a problem in the household. It's caused more arguments than any other device, any other thing in his entire life. And I just believe that teenage boys and pornography is going to be an ongoing issue. And if the government wants to regulate something online, let's regulate that.
Yeah, well, I think that's very well said, Peter. And if people want to hear more about in terms of that topic, Heidi Olson, go back to my replays. She's a SANE, a sexual abuse nurse examiner. It's an interview that I did before the break. It's quite harrowing, but it is definitely well worth a listen, particularly if online pornography is of a concern with you. Look, we're up on time. I just want to thank you very much for a wonderful discussion again. David Harvey, thank you, David, as always. And I think, as you said, hate crimes, I think that will be the next thing that we'll have to tackle in discussion. So thank you very much, David.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
And Peter, and too, as always, Peter. Yeah, watch the space.
All right. Thanks, guys. Nice talking with you.
Thank you.
This is The Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.